Hello, it's great to have you with me. I'm Kim Clyden, former ABC radio presenter and children's book author, creating a community of people who care about children. How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent, and empowered children? And they say it takes a village. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story.
Over the years, I've come to believe that performance alone is a poor measure of leadership. The deeper question, though, is whether people leave our influence stronger or smaller. My guest today is Justin Lippiatt. He spent more than two decades leading across industries including banking, manufacturing, education, agribusiness, sustainability, and hospitality. He's a senior executive, founder, and entrepreneur. But at the heart of his work is a far more human pursuit, building trust, dignity, and meaning into leadership. Justin is also the author of The Measure of Significance, a book shaped by a moment that never quite left him, a meeting where people were casually referred to as units of production. No malice, no objection, just a phrase that revealed one of leadership's most dangerous traps: optimising what's measurable whilst overlooking what's human. Justin's work today spans Indigenous-led botanical wellness, regenerative tourism, and small business sustainability, all grounded in the belief that enterprises should be commercially sound, socially meaningful, and built to last well beyond us. Justin, thank you so much for making yourself available to me. How do you think your formative years, and particularly the influences you had in your life, prepared you for who you are now and the risks you take?
Well, as you can tell, I was born in South Africa and grew up in a middle-class family, but there was quite a lot of dysfunctionality there. Both my parents were heavy drinkers. And so by the age of 12, my mother and father got divorced. I went off to boarding school and I just never seemed to fit in when I was at boarding school. I was always the outcast. I never seemed to fit in anywhere. And so when I got to the age, I think of about 15, I started to drink. And my father at that stage decided that having a son who was a drinking buddy was more beneficial than not. I started to drink a lot. And that sort of laid the foundations for me becoming somewhat of a hardcore alcoholic and drug abuser down the track. I've been sober now for 28 years, which has been an amazing journey. But I guess it helped me to realize that everybody needs somebody. Everybody needs somebody. And so I formed relationships with, you know, high-level business leaders, government leaders, just with all kinds of people, because I realized that somebody needs somebody, whether you're a goth, whether you're a jock, whether you're a nerd, whether you're a musician, everybody needs somebody. And so for me, when I started my career, I was still, you know, carrying the scars of hardcore alcoholism, having drank my first marriage away, really experiencing very deep depression, suicide thoughts. You know, just I wanted it all to be over. And I guess part of the journey for me was to understand more about myself so that I could help others understand more about what they were going through. As I have done for many, many years, is I've encouraged people that are going through addiction or trying to come out of addiction. One of the best antidotes to self-hatred or self-loathing is to actually invest into other people going through the same thing. When I started to take on leadership roles, I always thought, well, I'm not going to be the dictatorial person that I always thought leaders were. You know, those autocratic ivory tower type leaders. I wanted to be somebody that was authentic and real. I didn't want to be everybody's friend, because sometimes you can't have those courageous conversations. But I did want to be in a place that I could really, really engage with people, and in a place where I had a full understanding, not always a full understanding, but I had an idea that people were real, that they had lives, marriages, ups, downs, kids. You know, there's a whole life attached to people. And so, you know, when I was going through all of these, the businesses and organizations that I've been part of and had the privilege of running, I call it the proximity audit. And that's how you kind of are aware of people around you. It's not just about the business focus decision, profit and loss. That's all we got, you know, win at all stakes. You can start there, I guess, but you got to bear in mind that that comes at a cost. It always comes at a cost. And so for me, it's about how we generate those conversations in a way that is loving, that is peaceful, calm, but mindful, I guess. I think that that's one of the keys for me. It's about mindfulness and being mindful of others.
Well, it sounds like you've led a pretty mindful life from quite early on. Not many people can take adversity and turn it around the way you did. You know, that experience of your childhood and home life that created the person who wanted to drink their life away actually had the wherewithal to think about proximity and the people they surrounded themselves with. I mean, how did you come to be in the realm of great leaders?
By accident. I think it's for me, it was about trying to be an armor bearer. I'm not sure if you are aware of that concept of antiquity, where a king would have an armor bearer to carry his weapons into battle. And so for me, it was trying to be the armor bearer to high-level business people, politicians, serious leaders. Was I may not have all the tools to be a great leader, but what I'll do is I'll carry your weapons. I'll learn from you. I'll glean as much as I can from you, so that one day when I'm big, I'll be a good leader. I'll learn all the mistakes. I have so much lived experience. I often say that my scars are a roadmap to my past, not a highway to my future. So, you know, for me, it's about, okay, well, I've learned all of this stuff. It's got me so far, but for me to go to be the kind of leader or the person that I want to be, I need to actually be the armor bearer to leaders. And so in time, I sort of learned to engage with people without intimidation or shyness or anything like that. I corresponded with Her Majesty the Queen over 10 years. First letter I sent to Her Majesty the Queen was, I saw her on TV and she looked so sad. And I said, Your Majesty, I'm just reaching out to you to say, hey, I'm just really thinking of you today, but I'm not thinking of you as the Queen of England. I'm thinking of you as a grandmother, as a wife, as somebody that's carrying the burden of the world upon your shoulders. And I just wanted to let you know that I'm here for you. And, you know, got a response back from Buckingham Palace, from her First Lady in waiting, saying, thank you so much, Her Majesty. Really appreciates the time that you've taken to reach out and I guess engage with her at that level. You know, everybody needs somebody. And so it's about not being intimidated by other leaders. I learned something when I came to Australia in 2007. The dunny is a great leveler. Everybody's very, very human at a basic form, and everybody needs to have somebody they can love and, be loved on, you know?
Love that. That's a great analogy. And it does remind us, you know, that we're more the same than we are different, which is one of the things I often talk about on this program. And we forget that because I think we've developed this dog-eat-dog world and everyone's trying to clamber on the top of everyone else to get to their top. Considering the high profile of some of the leaders you've surrounded yourself with over your lifetime, who's had a lasting influence, particularly on those values that you espouse to the Queen?
I think the business leader that has probably had the most significance on my leadership and my professional career must be Marcus Buckingham. Marcus is a strength-based leadership guru, and he was the guy that wrote Now Discover Your Strengths, based on the Gallup and Clifton Strength Finder. He's an amazing guy, and I had the privilege of meeting with him in 2019, and I remember sitting across at the World Business Forum with Marcus Buckingham, you know, like, wow, I didn't know what to say. And so I came up with, you know, these stupid things like, so Marcus, tell me, what are the five big traits of a great leader? He said, I hate that question. And I thought, well, what do you mean? He said, Justin, there's no five-star leader. He said, you have one natural leadership gift. Maybe two, a third developed, The other two are BS. So when you're looking, when you're trying to create this environment where you're looking for a five-star leader, you're actually setting people up to fail. Because you are forcing them to operate in an environment that they're not competent at, that they're not engaged with. And so for the most part, we set people up to fail in leadership because we have these overarching expectations that are just not realistic. So I thought, oh, wow, that sort of shocked me to the core. And then I guess the second thing is, and he said, the other problem is that leaders are so focused on developing leaders that they leave the followers behind. And so for me, it's like there was another shock. It was, okay, well, I actually need to change the way I view the world. I need to be able to say, well, actually, I want to help people become the best followers they can be. And if they have leadership traits, they will float to, I always say, great leaders always float to the top, right? Then I will nurture and develop those, but I won't raise leadership as an expectation of followers. So if you want to be in my world, I don't need you to be a leader. I just need you to be a great follower. And by follower, I don't mean, you know, some sort of subservient or submissive person. I just mean somebody said, hey, Justin, you know what? I'm just so great to, I just want to work every day. I want to do my job to the best of my ability. I want to do what's best for the organization, but I don't have any aspirations of being a leader. I don't want to be a leader. You have to just accept that there are people like that, and you work with those people to the best of their ability for the best of the better of the organization. So Marcus had a significant impact on me. And then at the end of 2021, I was one of the first cohorts to do Love Plus work with Marcus Buckingham and Harvard Business Review. And it was a phenomenal book where I really started to embed this philosophy in my life of loving a team to higher performance. When you say, I've been able to demonstrate that I can love a team to higher performance, people sort of give you that, oh, that sounds a little bit creepy. I don't know how else to say it, you know, but effectively encouraging them, providing their support, lifting them up, the edification, the, come on, guys, we can actually do this. But beyond just the fluff, you know, it's recognizing where people's strengths are and how they're wired so that everybody can, I guess, work together for the better of the organization. And hopefully those people will come off better knowing you and having worked for the organization that they would have been without it.
Treating people like human beings. Gee, that sounds like a novel idea in an organization.
Yeah, imagine that, yeah.
Just shouldn't be that hard, should it?
Not exactly.
You've experienced many, many industries in the leadership field. And in your roles throughout your career, you've had the opportunity, obviously, to model things like you've just mentioned from Marcus, but influence really only takes us so far. So which of those careers in those industries presented the most challenges for you to hone your leadership skills?
I think the most highly regulated industries, I think, are the ones where it may be hardest to shine because of bureaucracy, because of regulatory frameworks, legislation, that kind of thing. So for me, it would probably have been in education because my aspirations were not always met, or my dreams or the way I wanted to engage weren't always met with the same enthusiasm. At the time, I was in Gympie, several years ago. We had a massive flood. The first thing I did was go to the year 12 and year 11 teachers and say, let's grab the students, let's chuck them on a bus, I'll come down, we'll put some wellies on and we'll go and help people prepare for the flood and we'll help move out shops and get all this stuff done. And it was rah, rah, rah. And then all of a sudden there was a whole lot of, well, have you done a risk assessment? Have you done this? Have you done this? Have you done this? And so it's not bad. It's just different. And so you have to learn how to navigate your way through risk, how you need governance. There's a whole lot of structure around, which is important. But then how do you find yourself within the sandbox? Like how are you able to be who you truly are within an environment so that you can still let your light shine every day, so you can still be a positive influence and make positive impact on people around you if you boxed in. And so it takes time for you to kind of navigate that and to try and figure out how you do that. And in time, you start to work with a system. So, you know, I wanted to do stuff with year fives and sixes called the Young Tycoons Program. And I said, I've got this great idea. I floated it past the newspaper, the press, business leaders. Yes, fantastic. Let's all do it. Go to the principal. Said, is it part of the Australian curriculum? No. Well, then it's more work for the teachers. Well, no, it's not going to be more work for the teachers. So I had to figure out where does it fit in the Australian curriculum? How do we provide the support to be able to support the teachers to be able to have some free time in the classroom whilst we are helping them do their job supporting kids in education? So I don't know. Education was really, really difficult. And I think banking was the other one as well. You know, you really want to help people that are going through a really, really tough time. You know, the money's not yours. And credit risk governance frameworks that are so embedded in that system don't allow you to make the decisions you want to make. You've got a lady sitting across the table with you that whose car's getting repossessed. And you say, I can do what I can, but there's not much I can do. So I think, I guess in short, to answer the question, I think it's in the most highly regulated, legislated environments that you would find that being the most difficult to implement those sort of wild ideas of trying to help people be the best people they can be rather than feed a bureaucracy or something like that.
I hear you. In fact, you touched on a couple of things that are passions of mine, being education and financial literacy is definitely something lacking in our curriculum, yeah, considering the future we all face. The other one is digital media skills, which we've just identified as a major gap in our education system, given our kids have had access to all of these digital applications and multi-generational media platforms to publish on without having any insights into that. You touched on something else there about working with future generations, leaders right across the board through multiple industries, and now working with more generations than they ever have before. And it's about to become, I think, five or six generations that they'll be working with. So each of those has various motivations and their own lens on employment, communication, worldview. How is that challenging this leadership style that has been around for decades?
I think it comes down to the what. So in the last, you know, 20, 30 years, we've spoken a lot about the why. Why do you want to do this? What is your big why, Simon Sinek? You know, let's figure out the why, because the why is the driver. But ultimately it comes down to the what. So for me, regardless of the generation, there is a what. What would you like to do? How would you like to do it? And why? Rather than why? What is your big why? Ask any 9-year-old what their big why is. They've got no idea. Ask them what they want to do when they're big or what when they grow up. They've got some idea. Ask a lot of year 10, year 11 students what they want to study at university if they want to go. Got no idea. So, well, what do you enjoy? Let's start at the what. So in this book that I was talking about, Love Plus Work, it's about trying to find that red thread, which is the things that we love in life. Now, I love surfing, but I can't go surfing every day. I mean, I'm not Mick Fanning or any of those guys, unfortunately. So I actually have to earn a living. So what are the intrinsic things about surfing that I love so much that I can actually massage or weave into my day so that I can actually do the things that I love without necessarily having to do that thing that I love? Everybody has, regardless of age, has this red thread. And so for us who are the generation before or the generation after, sometimes it's helping people discover what that red thread is. Students in university, you know, big kids that want to drop out of university. So, well, what are you studying? I hate what I study. But what is it that you actually want to do? I want to help people. Okay, well, are you in the right degree? Let's start with the what. So I think that's the intergenerational question, is not the why. Because as we all know, from the boomers all the way through to Gen Alpha, the why has been so different. Why they engage at work, why they make great employees. So we've got to take the why out, not dissing Simon, but just saying, you know, we've got to focus on what makes these young people engaged, and then figure out how to do that, and then figure out why that actually works for them.
I know you said Marcus had told you that there weren't, you know, five top skills. People have a top one or two and a third they might be able to develop. But what skills do you think are actually required to lead effectively today that people might want to consider developing?
I think it's empathy. I think empathy is the biggest skill we can learn. I was the retention guy for the bank that I used to work in South Africa. I used to deal with all the high net worth and corporate client hard cases, I guess. And the bank wanted to pay for me to do professional development, a BCom, an MBA, whatever, to help me do my job better. And I said, well, can I do something that I think is going to have more value? And the managing director of retail said, well, anything, what is it you want to do? And I said, I want to do the Lifeline counseling course. And he said, well, how's that going to help? I said, well, because the first engagement I will have with a client is going to be on the phone, and I'd rather listen to the context rather than the content. I'd rather make an emotional connection with the person, because that way I can have a conversation later on rather than to try and beat them down with policy and rules, regulations, and a whole lot of information. So I think that empathy is the number one skill that we're going to need, especially in the AI age, where people are starting to use a lot of AI, where people are engaging with AI, where this concept of super agency is coming about, where there's this cooperation or collaboration between AI and human beings. We need to retain our humanness more than ever before. The only thing that really makes us different to all the other animals, and we can argue horses, dogs, cats, whatever, but the one intrinsic thing that makes us different from all other animals is our soul. And our empathy lives there. So for us, empathy is the biggest skill we need to navigate in the world to come. As leaders, that's what we need to make sure people have got. And so how do you test that? You've got numerous tools, but emotional intelligence, and I guess tied with empathy, listening rather than just hearing. And my wife may attest to the fact that, you know, I can have selective hearing at times, but sometimes I just got to listen to what she's saying, not just hear what she's saying. But I think that's the key skill. How do we teach empathy for leaders?
I love it when a man describes a situation with his wife that mirrors my own life and probably millions of others. Honestly, you really hit the nail on the head there. And I hope my husband's listening to this episode. So, Justin, my final question for you, and it's really a look into the future. How do you think we as individuals and as a society should prepare successive generations to lead through the challenges that lay ahead?
Wow. I think we need to change the way we think about how young people are going to lead in the future. We need to think about the environment that they're going to be leading in. The big focus on the Sunshine Coast is, and in Brisbane is, you know, 2032. But if you talk to young people at school, you know, the young man that's playing soccer at school, or the young lady that's playing netball, they're 9 or 10 years old, maybe a bit older, but you could say, hey, there's an opportunity for you. If you apply your skills, how would you feel about playing in the 2032 Olympics? Wow, yeah, that would be so cool. So, well, you're an ace netballer. What are you doing to develop those skills? How are you going to get there? And so I think what we've got to do is we've got to actually position these younger people for a future that helps them be bigger versions of themselves rather than better versions of themselves. But because if I go to somebody and I said, Kim, I want you to be a better version of yourself, I'm implying that there's something wrong with you, right? If I say to you, Kim, I want you to be a much bigger version of yourself that has a far different connotation than before. So I want young people to be the biggest versions of themselves they can actually be. And I want, from the very beginning, for them to identify what that red thread is. What am I good at? What do I love? And then if those are my guardrails, and I've got people around me, adults that can help guide me on this, if those are my guardrails, then I'll always be somewhat aligned to my true north. Otherwise, if I go off the tracks, I want to help people. I can do it in banking, but actually what I really want to do is counseling. Then I could be a great banker, but really it's not that's not really my what. My real what is I want to help people in counseling. So, I mean, we've just got to listen more than ever before, I think. I always say that diversity is when we celebrate the things that make us different, and inclusion is when we celebrate the things that make us the same. And so we are all very different and all very much the same at the same time. It's the paradox of life. And so helping young people to navigate that paradox is also really, really crucial. So I think, you know, even teaching them from a very young age around empathy, about looking forward, about that element of sustainability. It's not just about hugging trees. It's about how are you going to have an impact in the future? What is this all about? So you want to be a doctor, or you want to be a businessman, or you want to be a tradie. Those are all great things. What does the future look like for you that as a tradie? You want to go camping? Great. How do you want to go camping? You want to do this? All those kinds of things. We need to start to think broader than just trying to put people straight into the Australian curriculum. And I'm not dissing it at all. I'm just saying that kids are very different to my generation. I was going to say yours, you look a lot younger than I am, so I won't say our generation. But I still remember, you know, three or four families in the street using one. There was one family that was probably a little bit more affluent than the rest. I remember us all sharing the Encyclopedia Britannica because only one family in the street had that. Then I got my own set of Encyclopedia Britannica, and then I got into huge trouble from my dad because I cut the pictures out to stick in a school project. So the world has changed, and our children are changing, and the dynamics around them are changing. And the one thing that we can really do for them is love on them, show them that we love them, and I guess really sit down and do everything in the electronic age to make sure that we're listening, not just hearing.
Justin, you have reframed so much of my thoughts just in this one conversation today. It's been an absolute pleasure and an honour to meet you, and I hope we can have another conversation not too far down the track.
Absolutely, anytime.
That's Justin Lippiatt, leaving us with a powerful reframe that leadership isn't measured by output alone, but by what's left behind. Systems can be efficient and structures are necessary. They can also look impressive. Results can even shine on paper. But if the people inside those systems are shrinking, disconnected, or depleted, well, something essential has been missed. It's both sobering and hopeful that trust, dignity, and care aren't little extras in leadership. They're the foundation. Now, when we lead in a way that strengthens people, that impact ripples far beyond organisations. It ripples out into families, communities, and ultimately the lives of children who are watching how we show up. What we tolerate, model, and normalise today will become the legacy our children inherit tomorrow. Thank you so much for listening. I appreciate you. And remember, be the change you want to see in the world. We can do that together. I'm Kim Clyden. Until next week, be kind.